The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's our time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in rainy gray Bogota at the moment, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 371 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Now, in a bizarre twist of fate, well, I believed in the podcast, of course, but indeed I wasn't entirely aware that episode 370 with Ana Maria Morales about rescuing birds of prey, raptors, here in Colombia was going to be so popular. It's actually morphing or becoming the most popular podcast so far, most popular episode in 2021. So pretty exciting to hear about that. And thank you, Ana Maria, for your time and your, of course, unselfish sharing of all the information and, of course, anecdotes from your life. We're here in Bogota. Many Colombian cities are in lockdown. Of course, there is a huge upsurge in cases of the virus due to the Brazilian variant, the Brazilian strain that's kind of raising the country at the moment. So if you are in Colombia, if you're listening to this in Colombia or in an at-risk area, please be safe. Please be careful. Back to the podcast, of course. This is episode 371. It's Andrew Gold is our interviewee. Well, he just joins us for a good free-flowing conversation. Andrew Gold is a journalist. He's a TV presenter and makes documentaries. And some of you may have seen some of his documentaries. He did do a documentary on exorcisms in Argentina. He speaks five languages. He's lived in six countries. And this is where we come in. One of those countries is Colombia. So as I always say, people have a Colombia story. Of course, if they've been here or are connected in some way to Colombia, there's always a Colombia story there. And he shares his Colombia stories with us. But a little bit about Andrew. He's battled an abusive exorcist. He's dueled with the crazy baby lady. He's hunted UFOs. He's working on a book. And there's some fun facts about Andrew as well, just to whet your appetite a little bit more. Viggo Mortensen, so the very famous actor, I believe Viggo grew up in Argentina, but Viggo Mortensen made fun of Andrew on live Argentine TV. After a joke went wrong on TV, he became known in Argentina as the last English virgin. He represented England in beer pong. And lost to a 12-year-old Panamanian girl. He was tear-gassed and water-cannoned while filming a doc about abortion. I imagine that was in Argentina as well. He studied English at Leeds Uni, holds an NCTJ in journalism, and knows shorthand. So there you go. He's won prizes, Best International Documentary at the Thin Line Festival in Texas on the documentary on exorcism. It's called Exorcism, the Battle for Young Minds. And, of course, BBC Three's Best of 2018 list and monthly editor's pick for the Sunday Times Pick of the Week. He's an Apple New and Noteworthy, recommendee for the On the Edge podcast. And tune in. He's a great guy. And we have a wonderful conversation. And, of course, we just kind of let him go. And he talks about his life, talks about his experience. And even we talk about picking noses. So there you go. So check out the Andrew Gold podcast, and that's andrewgoldpodcast.com. Of course, we've got the links on Facebook and Twitter and so on. And enjoy this podcast. Again, this is a shout out to those of you out here in Colombia at the moment. Malcolm Linton, who was on episode, I think it was 369 or 368, he will be giving photography workshops in Mompox, Colombia, at the end of May, in July, and in August. He is a renowned conflict photographer with experiences in Panama, El Salvador, Nicaragua, genocide in Rwanda. He's obviously covered the FARC camps here in Colombia. But he, you know, spoiler alert, he was first shot. The first time he was shot was in Panama during the U.S. invasion of Panama, Noriega's Panama at that time. Anyway, he's offering photography workshops at a really reasonable price. Just check out malcolmlinton.com, and on there it will say Mompox workshop, and you can sign up there for quite an incredible opportunity to study and have your work critiqued by a top photographer in a UNESCO World Heritage Site of Mompox. And of course, where I come in is that we're offering net rate stays in the Casa Maria in Mompox and of course San Rafael in Mompox for the duration of those courses. So please take a look and sign up. And so I'm going to go now. I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart, journalist, UK journalist in Medellin, who will deliver the news segment for this week. And we'll be back again in segment three with Andrew Gold, talking really about his life. We're getting an insight into the mind of Andrew Gold. So this is episode 371 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you again for listening. And as always, I'm so thrilled for feedback and anything you want to hear or say about the podcast. Review us, please. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of the 12th of April, 2021. Social and trade union organisations have called for a national strike and mobilisation on April 28th. Indigenous groups have also announced they will be joining the movement. The central motivation is the new tax reform bill announced by the government. The plans are being called the most unjust and unjustified reform of the last 30 years, risking more inequality and even more hunger, taking money from Colombia's worst off rather than the country's wealthiest. Although the final text of the reform remains unknown, it will seek to broaden the basis of taxes such as income tax and VAT in order to raise money for public spending. The bill has been particularly controversial in its announcement that products such as sugar, coffee, salt and chocolate would be taxed with 19% VAT because, according to the government, they are not basic products for Colombians. After national criticism, the president was forced into a U-turn on the taxation of those products, but the government has announced new austerity measures for public spending for this year. According to organisers, the mobilisation will be in person and in the streets, as the third wave of the pandemic is expected to have fallen by the planned date. Another massacre in the Cauca, with four people murdered in the rural zone of Santander de Quilachao. The massacre is Colombia's 26th so far this year. Five of the year's massacres and five assassinations of social leaders have taken place in Cauca, one of the Pacific region's historically neglected areas. Colombia's coal crisis deepens as Prodeco, the largest coal producer in Colombia, has asked to return its mining titles and been denied by the National Mining Agency. Since the pandemic began, Prodeco suspended operations and began to take voluntary retirement plans for its employees and to lay them off. As global coal prices continue to drop, many companies, both national and multinational, are looking to divest coal assets across Colombia. Although Prodeco has not left the area yet, the suspension of its operations and the departure of around 700 workers has hard hit the economy of the area they operate, La Jagua de Ibirico. The agency's argument in its rejection of the request is that there are unfulfilled environmental obligations and inadequate support for the liquidation and payment of royalties. An attempt to legalise euthanasia has been sunk in Congress. The project of Liberal representative Juan Fernando Reyes sought to approve euthanasia for seriously ill patients. The promoters of the project needed 85 yes votes to continue, but only obtained 82. 4.4% of Colombians have now received one dose of coronavirus vaccine, 1.6% are now fully vaccinated. Meanwhile, case numbers continue to climb as the third wave hits. Daily cases are now at around 17,000, up from around 3,000 at the start of last month and 10,000 at the start of this month. Cities all over the country are re-entering partial or complete quarantines. Curfews are now common and alcohol sales bans are widespread. ICUs are near full capacity in many cities. That was the news for this week. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall. La canoa de Bareque, para llegar a la playa.
And we're back. This is the third segment of Colombia Calling, episode 371. I'm in Bogota, back from Mompós on the Caribbean coast. And my very special guest this week is, well, it's Andrew Gold. Some of you will know who he is. He's, a broadcaster, journalist, journeyman. But right now, his podcast is making waves. It's called On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I listened to it, so there you go. And it's just fascinating. But what you might not have known is that there is a Colombia connection here. So as tenuous as it may be, I will find anyone with a Colombia connection and talk about them here on the Colombia Calling podcast. So Andrew from in Berlin, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you for having me. Woo!
You're most welcome. It's a real treat because, I mean, I listen to you, I would say, more than once a week now because I'm still catching up. And your podcast, I can only assume that it's going from strength to strength because you're getting some really incredible people. I still haven't listened to one or two, which I think I might not be able to stomach, and you'll probably be able to guess which ones those are. But the most recent one I've listened to is the lady, I guess, captured in Pakistan or incarcerated in Pakistan. So tell us a little bit why you set up this podcast.
Well, yeah, I had been making documentaries and things. I've worked as a presenter and I guess a filmmaker, although I didn't really ever do any of the camera stuff. I was more of a journalist, so I wanted to be on screen. It was sort of a cop-out because it was that I wanted to make films and stuff, and people would say, like, oh, would you want to be behind the camera? And it looked like I was this big egotist, like, no, I've got to be on screen. But it was actually because I knew I didn't have that sort of directing talent that a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. And then the option is, like, well, you can be a producer. And I thought, I mean, for some people, that's great, but for me it was like, what do I want? What I want to arrange stuff. I mean, that's the most boring part of like going on holiday or whatever, isn't it? Arranging stuff. I don't want to arrange stuff. I want to like be in the scene and chatting to the guy and that kind of thing. So it became, I got some stuff out for the BBC and some TV channels, and it became increasingly difficult to make any sales commissions. Even the stuff I made, I had to make it first because it always got rejected. So I made it first, which just with no money and no budget and stuff. And anyway, long story short, I had been thinking of doing a podcast. Then I thought, oh, but everyone does them because I think there are more podcasts than there are people now. So, and I thought, well, what more do I have to offer? But then I thought, I kept getting no's for some of these stories about people who I just thought, no, but that story's got to be told. That person's amazing. Got to do that. And eventually I was like, you know what? I can't wait anymore. I can't, because they don't say no. They very rarely say no, TV channels. They always say like, okay, well, we're going to speak. And it's months and months and years and years. And then that person moves to another channel you're starting again. So I just thought, you know what? I'm doing it again. I'm doing this as a podcast and I'm going to get these people out there, and people have taken to them, you know. It's enjoyable talking.
Well, they have. So give us a little bit of an idea. I mean, these stories are incredible. They are incredible and a bit offbeat, I'd say. Not your routine stories. And of course, I guess On the Edge is being edgy, but how many downloads, how many listeners are you drawing in now? And you've got a Patreon campaign, which I think is going very well, but how many, for like the average podcast episode, how many downloads do you get in a week or a month or so?
It gets in the first week, a download, an episode will get 12,000-13,000 or so. But then the funny thing is that people used to measure in like months. They used to say, so what does it get in the first month? And that was like your amount. But I find that you get like 99% in the first week and then like two people listen for the next 3 weeks. Yeah. The thing that's misleading and frustrating with it is, I mean, some of the ways that I've gotten listeners has been when the podcast has been sort of selected by some of the platforms, because obviously everybody knows Apple and Spotify, and most people are listening to this probably on those apps as well. But Castbox, Stitcher, and that's what I started from the beginning. I was looking at these smaller ones where I thought, oh, maybe I'll send them an email and just let them know about my show and see what happens. And it got put on there, and it's misleading because what happens is you get like these hugely inflated numbers and you think like, wow, I'm taking off. So, you know, just a few weeks ago, I was getting like 25,000 in a week for a new episode. I was like, what? And then it comes down from the feature or not 25,000 necessarily from a new episode, but in total, all of the whole thing. It comes down and then it drops massively. And what's happening is obviously some people just listen once and it's not for them. And then other people, like yourself, they're catching up. So you get this huge bounce because they listen once and they're like, oh, I love it. I'm going to listen to all 40 of them. And then they've caught up. And then you sort of tail off and you go back to, you know, that person only listens once a week from then on.
That's really cool. But anyway, I mean, you leave me, as they say in Spanish or in Colombian Spanish, me has dejado en pañales. I'm in nappies alongside that kind of number. So it's very flattering.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a great podcast. I listen on Stitcher, by the way, just so you know.
You're one of the Stitchers.
Yeah,
okay.
I just prefer. And while I get most of my downloads and listeners on Apple and on Spotify, I prefer to shop around in different apps. I just think it's, you know, they deserve to all of the exposure possible against these behemoths. But so, I mean, you know, I want my listeners and the few that I have to sort of look at your list of your podcasts. To some people, who, I mean, my listeners tend to be, I think, between sort of 20 and I would say upwards of 40 as well. It's quite a big group there, but very well traveled. Very well traveled, of course. They want to go to Colombia or they've been to Colombia. It's not, this doesn't go out to like an expat community or an immigrant community. Most of my listeners, a lot are in the US and are of Colombian descent, second or third generations. Sure. So it's quite interesting that. And if they were to sort of say, well, Andrew Gold, what of your episodes so far would you recommend to people out there as being the ones that should get them hooked?
I often say, when people ask, I often say, I think it's episode 12, and it's a female Mormon psychopath.
Yes.
She's a self-confessed psychopath. And I just like her. I like my dynamic with her. She's coming back on actually for my 50th episode in a couple of weeks. I'm speaking to her in a couple of days. And it's just, that was one of those ones where I enjoyed it myself because I'm sitting talking to somebody who's, again, if you're talking about well-traveled, I mean, she's in Utah, she's a Mormon, she's so different from me. And she's telling me about, I don't know, I guess what you want as an interviewer is you want honesty. And I don't know, obviously I'm not going to rely on a psychopath for honesty. That's a stupid thing to do. But what I think a lot of us are always trying to show people that we're more empathetic than we are. We try to imagine we're very empathetic. And she was just honestly saying, you know, I actually just don't care. And I said to her, you know, would you mind if I died, if something happened to me while you were watching, if somebody strangled me? And she was just like, you know, no, and I don't think you understand how this works, Andrew. And I was like, wow. So it was just the honesty of that. And then I think episode 19 was with, and it depends how you know, if it might be difficult for people whose second language is English, the coffin confessor, who is this Australian fella, because he's very, a lot of slang and Australian and all this stuff. But he's this guy who goes to people's funeral. He gets paid $10,000 or something by people who are dying. And then he turns up at their funerals and reveals secrets that they wanted revealed at their funerals. So just it was such a beautiful thing that I somehow stumbled across online. And I just thought, wow, I have to talk to him. And there were deeper reasons as to why he does what he does. And he's actually a beautiful soul. He's a really interesting guy. But again, it was truth. And go on.
I like that one a lot. There's a lot of humor in it, but as you say, he really felt he was doing something of a service. It wasn't like there was a short story done by Roald Dahl many, many years ago, and it was about sort of revenge like that, where he'd send people around to like beat people up or something. You know, it was like, it reminded me of that. But this guy did it with heart. You know, you're Australian. Mm. He did it with heart. It was different. It wasn't, you know, he wasn't going there, you know, deliberately trying to offend people. It was a dying person's wish. And I really liked it. And of course, the slang was way out there. Way out there. Yeah. I mean, he was, I don't know if he was, you know, born on the outback or something, because it was it was hard.
So we went to this bikie's funeral, and he said to me, it was tough. But I mean, stuff happened to him when he was younger, and that gave him this obsession with outing the truth. Another one, if people are interested, would be Professor Sue Black. I'm not sure which episode it was. It was number 38, maybe, I'm going to go with. And she just blew my mind. And she's a criminal anthropologist, and she she has done some things like, you know, in the name of anthropology or whatever it is, she's gone to Kosovo and sort of melded through or rummaged through melted bodies to try and identify them. It's that kind of thing she has to do. She's carried like heads. She carried heads, people's heads on in designer bags on a passenger plane, sort of smuggled them on. She's an absolute hero because she knew she needed to be able to analyze them better in the UK. Fascinating person. So that one's one as well that I would recommend to people.
And they really are. And these are the result of just trawling through, going down rabbit holes on the internet and finding these people.
Yeah, yeah. There are times when I've got loads and loads of people lined up. By loads, I mean four or five. You know, I know people, I don't know how it is for you. I mean, do you have people in advance?
I try and do people just a week in advance. I try. If I'm traveling, then a couple of weeks. I've always got two or three sort of simmering away in the background, but I don't want to rush anything. And because I don't know, it's hard to make it timely all the time, but I try.
I try. Yeah. No, I totally get that. It is that struggle. Most of the time it's okay. Yeah, three or four people I might have lined up, which I do now. And then, I mean, somebody I had on called Madeleine Black, and that hasn't come out yet, the episode. It will maybe next week or the week after. But she came on. She, you know, unfortunately, when she was 13, she was gang raped, and she learned to forgive her attackers in a way. And I read her book and had her on. She has her own podcast, and I went on that. And she said when I got off, she was like, okay, so that will come out at the end of August. And this was like February. And I was like, she had 6 months of people recordings already lined up. And I was flabbergasted. Yeah, most people I speak to, they'll be out next week. Mm-hmm. There have been times, and there was particularly a time around Christmas when it was difficult to get people on. I suppose everyone's got family stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And I had just gotten to the point where my audience was large enough that they were sort of getting used to it and relying on it. And you hear all the time, don't you, that, you know, consistency, everybody has to know that your podcast, they have to trust your podcast is going to come out at the right time. So I was panicking, absolutely. And I even ended up like the day before it was supposed to come out, I had nothing. And this guy replied, who I'd actually tried months ago, called Johnny Benjamin, MBE. He's got schizoaffective disorder. And he's quite a famous sort of mental health advocate. So he was sort of a big deal for me to get on the podcast, and it was such a relief. And I was like, yes, please, now, can you do today? And we got it done. Otherwise, I look at stuff like the Guardian Experience column. They've got some great stuff there. I just found last week a guy told a story about how he was on that flight from Uruguay to Chile that crashed in the Andes.
The alive one.
Yeah. So he had just done a little article that, you know, because he's had a book out. And I just saw that and I went, oh, okay. And, you know, I thought maybe I can say, oh, because I lived in Argentina as well, after Colombia, I can be a bit like, che, que pasa, you know, come on my podcast. So he's coming on in a couple of weeks. So that Guardian Experience and websites like that, Twitter, you sort of word of mouth, people say, oh, have you tried so-and-so? And, you know.
So it's amazing. I'm definitely tuning in. Well, I tune into them all, but I'm definitely tuning into the one, the Alive story. That's something that's, I've just obviously seen the film. I read the book. I haven't spoken to anyone. I wanted to at one point, if it was possible. They were Uruguayan, right? They were a Uruguayan rugby team, something
that's
like
right.
That. So, well, I mean, there's. I have to say, and we sort of draw it back here, but there's some similarities here. In although I haven't got into TV so much or anything, but there's some similarities here because I tend to stick to print journalism. But you were working on a newspaper in the UK, and it was not something that I could say it didn't inspire you. And I think I went through a similar, although not as extreme, experience. I worked I walked out after 2 weeks on the social pages of a newspaper called the Daily Telegraph because I was being told back in, I want to say 2001 or 2002, something around then, to like chase Paris Hilton in nightclubs and things like that, which for about an evening was fun. And then after that, it was just dull. And so 2 weeks and I laughed, I walked out of that. But tell us about your experience, because I think on the same sort of basis, you just needed to get away. And that's something I think now, 18 years later, I'm still getting away. So tell us a little bit about the journalism experience back in the UK.
I'm surprised that was happening at the Telegraph, because it's for those who don't know, that's sort of probably our most highbrow newspaper, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a small social section that was called Peterborough back in the day, and now I think it's called London Spy or something, and it was... I think it's called that. I don't really pay much attention to it. I was referred to on the desk as the unimpressed one, the unimpressed boy, because I just didn't, I couldn't, you know, the person who came third in Big Brother 2, I had to look for, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that's what it's exactly what I was doing at The Sun, which is for those who don't know, that's more, is a lowbrow sort of yellow. They call it amarillo or something. Do they call it like that in Colombia?
Yeah.
I said that a few times in Argentina and no one knew what I was talking about.
No, here,
I
said,
it must have been Colombia. Yeah. Okay, that's what it is. So, it was a job. You know, it was my first job. I was 21, 22 or something. I'd been living in France for a few years before that, studying there and stuff, which I loved. And I loved languages. And basically, I was working nights at The Sun. And it was good money for what it was. You know, I've never earned anywhere near that money since then, in the 10 years that have passed since then. So I'm 32 now. I was 22 then. And I was also doing those kinds of stories. Oh, look, here's, you know, Beyonce without makeup on. How wonderful. Like, you know, who cares? And it was night shift. And it was, so I was working, you know, not that late, but 8 p.m. till 4 a.m. And then drove home, you know, through the night. And there'd be sort of, people partying and stuff. And I was like, this is, I couldn't do it really. I got through a whole winter. I was there for a year, year and a half. And what, one of the things I was responsible for most nights was ensuring that the Page Three girl, which was in this newspaper on the Page Three, everyone in the UK knows the Page Three girl, was a, sort of a woman newspaper. And even more ridiculous looking back, I think it was ridiculous at the time. And looking back, it was like, did that happen? I don't think they do that anymore.
I think they've cut off the topless images now, haven't they? And you were working nights at The Sun, a tabloid newspaper with a reputation, and you were in charge of making the Page Three model that goes out on the iPad 3D.
Yeah. So I don't know anything about computers or anything, but it was just a case of they showed me how to do it. It was the iPad. There was the iPad edition of the newspaper, because a lot of our work was just getting stuff online. It's boring even to talk about, but basically she was 3D, so you could twirl her around. I mean, the whole thing was just so utterly degrading for her. Well, you know what? I don't want to speak for her. I mean, if they want to do that, they want to do that. But it was degrading for me. That's how I felt. I had a cousin who was working out in Venezuela at the time. He'd gone out for a couple of years. He was going through a bit of a hippie stage, working on coffee farms and the like, you know, staying at each sort of thinker, you know, for a few weeks at a time. And he said that he and his girlfriend, who of the time, were basically moving around, and they had planned in a few months to be in Colombia. So he said to me, this was my cousin's soul. He said, we'll be there. This was like April or March or something. And he said, June the 23rd, we're going to get Chinchina, which is the smallest of small villages in the cafe region of Colombia.
Yep.
And he said, it was a very brief chat. It was like 3 a.m. where I was in The Sun. I hadn't spoken to him for years, but it's one of those relationships where we're very, very close, even if we don't speak for a long time. And it was, he just said, yeah, come out. We'll be there. I'll meet you at the police station at like, you know, 11 a.m. on the 23rd. And I was sort of thinking it was a laugh. And I was like, all right, mate, just messaging him. And I'd never done anything like this before. I then got The Sun to sort of let me do an article about the flower festival in Medellin. Mm-hmm. They didn't really want to do that, because why would The Sun do that? But it was like a travel piece. And the reason was because then I could go to Air France or whoever it was, I don't even remember, and say, can I have a free ticket? And we'll mention you in the piece for the newspaper. So I got a free flight, because I had no money. But so I got a free flight out. for the 23rd of June. And obviously, a few weeks before going, I messaged my cousin a few times, but he never had internet. He was in the middle of nowhere. So I didn't hear a thing from him from the moment we'd had this almost, I want to say drunken, but we hadn't drunk, but it was like that kind of chat late at night. And I started thinking that in the days before going, like, God, what if he, surely he might have changed his plans. What am I going to do? I don't speak any Spanish because I didn't at the time. I'd started learning through a few different, you know, Michelle Thomas and Babbel and all that stuff. And yeah, I just flew out there and decided not to get my flight back home. And I told my manager or whatever at the Sun, you know, I wasn't going to come back. I'm not sure I told everyone there or the airline. I don't know if I spoke, I don't know. But yeah, I went out there, got the flight to Bogota. And then there was a overnight bus from Bogota, I suppose, to Manizales. I think that sounds right. And then from Manizales, there was and it was one of the things where for me, obviously, when you're already out in Colombia, or you've been to these sort of quite distant places, remote places, it's all part, you know, it's part of it, you know. But for me at the time, this was like shocking and scary. I was 22 on my own, no money, no language and stuff. And I just remember that, yeah, that sort of van ride from Bogota to Manizales, horrible, overnight, boiling hot, water dripping through the ceiling. I was squashed between some quite overweight. I was squashed between an overweight couple. They were both, I'm not poking fun, but they were, you'd call them obese, I think, which is fine. I got no problem, you know, but when you're squashed between them, and I said to them, like, do you want to sit next to each other? I just remember this. I haven't thought about this in 10 years. I said, do you want to sit next to each other? And they were like, no, we're fine. And I was trying to get this out in Spanish. I couldn't speak at the time. I was like, juntos? And they were like, no, we're fine. And they were just talking across me the whole way for 8 hours. I was stuff dripping. It was the worst thing ever. From Manizales, I think we went to another town. And then from that town, I had to, for the first time in my life, I had to hitchhike. So just for a lot of people, potentially even people listening, this would be like, well, this is normal stuff in traveling. For me, this was not. At all, you know, 2 days before I'd been in the Sun's like, posh offices, fiddling with page three girl on iPad. And now I was in the middle of nowhere. And I just said to these people driving me, it was this little family of people in a little car. I said, could you take me to the police? Like, policia. They probably thought it was an emergency or whatever. What I didn't expect, and, you know, the police station was a hut. It was basically a hut with two, like, sleepy fellas there, and there was nothing for miles around, just mountains and greenery and tiny little wooden sort of shack. So it was all very scary and interesting. I got there, it's like 7 a.m. I haven't spoken to my cousin in months, and I hadn't slept for about 3 days because of the traveling. And I said to these police guys, I was like, my cousin's name's Sol, and I said, Sol, Solomon, Sol, like, that's all I knew. I just, and Rebecca or Becky, that was his girlfriend. And they sort of thought for a moment, I went, oh, see, I see, you know, because they were like, see, like, bien. So like, you know, and they let me go and sleep in their little hut. I had like a 4 or 5 hour sleep at sort of, this was 7 a.m, I think. And one of their little, it was like a sort of bunk bed, a little room with bunk beds where I guess they sleep. And I sort of had a little sleep for a few hours. And I got woken by my cousin, who I hadn't seen for years, jumping on top of me with his long hair and beard that had grown from being out there for years. And his girlfriend as well. They were both jumping on me and very exciting. And yeah, we worked out there on this coffee farm, which I'm not suited to. Everything hurt. Everything was, my neck was there. For a couple of weeks, it was 2-3 weeks. This woman's small little farm, we were just hacking away weeds and stuff that, you know, are interfering with the coffee plants. I then traveled around Colombia, not with him. We sort of hung around in Pereira, Armenia, like that kind of area for a while, Manizales. And then me and another, a friend of mine came out, and we sort of traveled around the whole of Colombia for 6 weeks. And then I settled in Medellin for almost a year, just sort of living.
I think that story about getting to the police station is phenomenal. That must have been, if it's 10 years ago, 2011. So,
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So I was already here, living here. And I love it that you, because it's the coffee zone where people are just so wonderful. And that's the truth of it. So well educated, so polite. And therefore, you came across your cousin unknowingly or knowingly. Organized for you to meet in a part of the country where you know, you were going to be received at the police station. There are parts of the country where they would not receive you at a police station and let you sleep in their bunk and arrange for, you know, an English hippie to pick you up in the morning.
It
sort of encompasses everything that you need to know about Colombia and how wonderful it can be and how nice the people and open they can be with you. And then obviously you weren't on the Finca Morelia or anything like that up in Chinchina, because I know where Chinchina is. And I've stayed on a coffee farm nearby, and actually for my small guest houses in Mompos, we ship in coffee from that town.
But
I doubt it's from the farm you were on. I don't know.
Well, you never know. Maybe I actually helped grow your coffee.
Maybe you did. maybe that was it. And then you settled. That's so great. They just sort of brought you in, sleep on the bunk. But it's awesome.
It was nice. It was a nice welcome especially after the night I'd had with these other fellas, you know, this couple on the bus. It was such a lovely, and obviously I was just so happy. It's one of the happiest memories I think I can remember probably in my life, actually. That speaks also to the fondness I have for my cousin, who's a couple of years older than me, and I hadn't seen him in such a long time. And also just the beauty of this thing, you know, when you're so used to the daily grind in London, which I had been, to have something where it's like we haven't spoken for months and I have no idea if he's going to even turn up. But he did, the exact hut in this what, as you know, is otherwise just endless hills and mountains of greenery and coffee and stuff.
I mean, it could have gone so wrong. And I just think you again stuck between two, let's say, supersized people on the bus, you know, the water dripping from the air conditioning. I can just imagine them talking over you, and you're just thinking, what have I done? Am I doing?
I was miserable. I was so miserable. I tried sleeping. At one point, I remember that I tried. I think the thing is, people, I guess they're from a different sort of economic stratus or whatever. You know, there's a word in Colombia, isn't there? Strata. Strata, they always use that word. It's so funny because outside of Colombia, I've never heard that. I remember that now. I was living with some Colombians in Medellin, and they were always like, well, that person's strata one. He's a bit of a strata five. And I was like, what are you talking about? But I guess people who are much more used to sort of that journey and that kind of lifestyle can bear it, you know, and they're just fine. And then they're sleeping and they're snoring and this. And I was just like, you know, I ended up lying on the floor, and it was like one of those sort of metal crinkly aisles that was just sort of, you know, and there's obviously really loud reggaeton playing the whole time, or whatever it was. I don't know if it was reggaeton, but it's something that I didn't know. And I'm just lying on the floor, and just all these people were looking. I was twice everyone's height as well, because I'm 6'4". So everyone's looking at me, and I was like, sueño, you know, cansado. I didn't know how to say it and all that. Yeah, horrible.
Oh, it's a great Colombia story. Everybody gets a Colombia story. That's my belief. It's a great Colombia story. And then, so hang on, you settled in Medellin for a year, and you were working. You managed to get some work, some remote work there, because I only bring this up because people email me, I would say, almost on a weekly basis, considering moving to Medellin for remote work. And now it's a hub for that. I mean, you can't swing a cat without finding a Canadian, an American, or someone, you know, on their Mac in a coffee shop, remote work.
Oblado. Yeah, it was, you know, something I never knew if I could do. I had the luxury of, I come from a middle-class background, and you know, nothing ridiculous or anything, just enough that if I ran into problems, my parents would pay for a flight back home.
Yeah.
That is a luxury that a lot of us, probably almost everybody who goes there has. And if you don't have that luxury, you can go, but I mean, it's a risk. So I knew that, okay, from the money I'd earned at the Sun, I had like 2 months if I didn't find anything. It wasn't very expensive to live out there. And worst case scenario, you never want to do this as an adult, because it's the self-respect thing, and your parents will never let you forget it as well. Whatever you do after that, it's like, well, we had to help you at that time. So that was last resort. And I got there and, started just messaging and emailing and saying I can write about this or that. And I was quite... because I was young, I was very, very idealistic about this and that. And it was like, I'm making this coffee, but who gets to drink coffee? You know, not the Colombians. It goes to, so I was writing for, you know, Occupy.com or what, you know, kind of, which I, you know, I'm not as interested in now, but at the time that was like my youth of exuberance. And yeah, that was it. And then there was a few other things. And look, at the end of the day, this is my experience of freelance, at least journalism, writing, and I'm sure you've seen the same thing and the same in filming and stuff, is that if you want to make a steady living, you've got to do, you know, corporate work in whatever domain it is. So I've got a friend who's like the best director I've met, right? He's fantastic. He did this Exorcist film that I got to the BBC. It was just me and him that made it together filming. He's brilliant. And he's now got work all the time. He didn't, but it's 99.999% corporate stuff. Gets flown around the world, right? He's at the top of that now. He's doing brilliantly. But he would also probably like to make some really creative stuff about, you know, the stuff that we made. And the same with writing. So the vast majority of the work I've done the last 10 years working remotely, which I still do in Berlin, has been for, you know, travel companies. And I would write about cities and hotels and beaches and whatever without actually going. They don't send you. If you want to be a travel writer where they send you, which I suppose a lot of listeners of yours probably have that dream, unfortunately, those people tend not to get paid very much or anything at all. The payment is in the trip nowadays. Obviously, back in the day, in the 70s and 80s, you know, that was a lucrative career. So you can do it. And it was fun at first. I was writing for, like, I think MSNBC and Occupy.com and a few other, Huffington Post or whatever. And you're getting sort of, okay, you work all week and you get 50 quid. It's not going to pay your bills. And then eventually I found a few companies that, you know, travel media writing or whatever it is. And that got me steady work. I didn't have to look for a story. The problem is you become lazy and you don't look for any stories then. You're just like, well, you know, and I ended up with a fairly nice place in quite an impoverished area. That was sort of my, the balance, you know, I wanted to go. It was somewhere in the west of Medellin. And it was really almost a slum where I was walking around. And yet it had this beautiful high rise with top security and all this stuff. And I was loving it. I was swimming in the pool every day and just, it was like a holiday for a year. And then going up and working for a couple of hours, writing about travel, some cities around the world and stuff. You can't do that forever, you know. After about, I got into almost a rut, because at first that's wonderful and the novelty. And obviously I made friends and stuff and we went out to Parque Sierras, which in Poblado is all kicking off. And we had fun and we, you know, traveled a bit, this and that. But the majority of the time I became a bit lazy, I think. And I sat on my laurels. Is that an expression? Yeah.
Yep. Rested on my laurels.
Rested on my laurels. Because you do, because you've got this luxury. I've never had that. I'm sitting by a pool and I've got these beautiful views around me and I'm working on my laptop for like 3 hours a day and writing about some cities in the world. Brilliant. After 10 or 11 months of that, I was like, I need to sort of kickstart my life now and get back to being ambitious, I suppose.
Now, I fell into that trap a long time ago as well. I really lost interest. You know, the format of writing about sort of hotels or trips that you could do. And I in the years between, I've fallen back into it every now and then for some, you know, dollar payments. And let's not lie.
Still do it.
But the joy with which I approached it as a young man without children is quite different to how I behave now. And I would still, you know, receive the dollar payments, you can tell that my heart's not in it. And, you know, I look back at it and you're like, that, you know, I can't do this. And I look down at, read over it again. So I'm glad that you went through, you know, that phase. And of course we'll go into the next phase, but you didn't fall into the trap of always having to mention Pablo Escobar in your articles when you're based in Medellin?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Of course I did. I was 22, so of course I did. But, well, not in my articles, because again, I wrote like four articles and one was about the flower festival. And then the rest of it was just, it became all corporate stuff.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly. Maybe I wrote 5 to 10 articles. I don't even remember what they were about. And then it was all just working for different companies. Go to this place in Miami and this is what you'll find. And, you know, the other thing is that what I would say, and the difference is, of course, being young. So firstly, when you're young and you don't have kids and you're 22, it's very different because you just feel like, okay, I could do this for a year or two. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter because eventually I'll, you know, but you do have to have that moment where you stop it eventually. And mm-hmm. Like I said, I still do that work, but I'm striving for other things as well and then mixing it up. Whereas back then I was like happy to do the minimum to have enough to survive and sit by the pool. That was it. Mm-hmm. The other thing was back then, and it was the same when I first got to France, I love languages. So I lived in Brazil for a while and then Germany. And each time the first year or so, it was like the excitement was, okay, even if I haven't achieved anything else all day, I probably learned two new words or something. So that you're progressing, you know?
Do I recall you saying in one of the podcasts you speak like seven languages?
Five languages.
Five, seven, who's counting now? I mean,
well, yeah, but it's even less impressive when I say I include English among them. So I'm like, I never say I learned five languages. I always very carefully say I learned to speak five languages.
Very good. Still very impressive. I mean, still very impressive.
Well, it's just, look, it's where you are, you know, it's where you stay and live, and it's the girlfriend or friends you have. So my Spanish when I left Colombia was good. It was passable. I could go out. I lived with Colombians, and they didn't speak English, so we chatted and stuff. What was really funny was moving to Argentina then, and I did not understand a word mm-hmm. of what anyone said, and I felt it was close to having to learn another new language mm-hmm. almost. And now, if you to hear me speak Spanish, you wouldn't know I ever set foot in Colombia. Mm-hmm.
I first arrived here having worked in Peru a long time and checking into a hostel way back in the day, and they were like, yeah, okay, English passport, but you're Anglo-Peruvian, right? And I was like, no. But it happens. I mean, it happens. Yeah. Now my Spanish is very much punctuated with the costeño accent because of all the time I spend up there, and people in Bogota just look at me. It's like, you're this gringo speaking like a costeño, but you know, you pick it up, and it's the way you have to communicate. It's the truth of it. And we're coming to an end, but I know that my listeners, you ended up in Buenos Aires and you stayed there for what seems like a generation. I mean, was it 6 years?
Yes, 6 years.
Wow. And so, that's it. And now you've moved with your Argentine girlfriend to Berlin.
Yeah. It was 6 beautiful years out there and a lot of time with her and her family. That's always been something I wanted. It sounds, I don't want it to sound sort of cynical or something, but I wanted to meet a local, maybe girlfriend or something. It was something I found difficult in Medellin for, you know, whatever reason. In Argentina, I met my girlfriend, Juli, and I love that because it was like I'm away from home and I'm doing all this sort of adventurous stuff, but then I have sort of a base, which is her family, going around every Sunday for dinner and the Argentine grandparents and all that kind of thing, and the asado, although I became vegetarian later. It was too much. It was too much meat, all the asados and the barbecues in Argentina. But it was a beautiful time. And eventually, again, it was like, it's time to leave. And she had always sort of had, aspirations to maybe go to Europe. She's a lawyer. So she got her law degree done. We waited. That's why it was so long, 6 years. While I was out there, I did this film about an exorcist who was abusing young women, got that out on BBC. So that was good for my career. And then, we had the opportunity to come to Germany. And we thought, okay, new language, new everything. And you know, we've been here 2 years now, Berlin, and then we're probably leaving in 3 to 6 months because she wants to convert to being a British, the UK law system. So finally, after, 10, 11 years, it's time to go home.
Big step back to the UK, especially after, having moved around so much. I mean, 6 years in Argentina, it shows certain dedication, but still moving around a lot, not your home country and so on, and big step for her to go across. But, I would think in a few years after the UK, you're both going to get itchy feet again. I mean, it seems to be very much in your DNA, in your makeup. So we'll see. Yeah. But so what's the master plan then? I mean, as we wind this down, you get back to the UK, you're taking over, a TV show, more documentaries. What are we looking at?
I've semi-given up on that, the documentaries. It is just too difficult. And right now there is a big push on like diversity and stuff like that. And without getting, controversial or anything, like if you step into a production company right now, they don't want a white man, right? They say that to me. And then they say, but you could go behind camera or something. And I'm like, well, I've talked to that's the reason I don't want to do that. I find that boring, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But there are so many things you can do. So I want to keep going with the podcast, grow it. If the podcast gets to a point where it's a little bit more than it is now in terms of audience, I'll be able to support myself. Mm. Especially if my girlfriend's a lawyer in the UK, we'll be fine. Yeah. And then I'm writing a book about secret keeping right now. It's in with a literary agent. So if that comes out, I'd love to just write books, make the podcast. I don't need a life of luxury or anything like that. Just that's a nice life, isn't it? I'm happy with that.
When people fill out this survey, because you put it up on Twitter, can you see where the responses came from?
No.
Good, because I filled it out.
Thank you for filling it out. Yeah, no, I have no idea. You know what? It's so funny. So for people who don't know, yes, I put out a survey because and the thing is, look, these books, you find surveys from like actual sociologists and psychiatrists and stuff like that. So the books eventually will be filled with that stuff, but it's a little bit more boring, their stuff. Their stuff's obviously professionally done. There's so many steps that a professional has to do, whereas I just went, right, lots of questions, you answer them, fucker. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Sorry. But I just thought, how many scientists are asking about nose picking at home? How many are asking about masturbation and things like that? I don't think there are many out there that are as sort of gross and ridiculous and silly. And I thought that will help me get to sort of the essence of what it is to be human at home. I do get a bit, and it's part of why I've done the podcast as well. I do get very frustrated and bored by our sort of the face we have to present to the world. Not that I think we should have to go out and pick our noses in front of each other. I think it's great that we don't do that, but I also don't, I think it's bad that, and nose picking is just an example, but I think it's bad that a lot of us feel shame for doing certain things we do. We imagine we're the only ones, and we're certainly not. What's funny is, I mean, as you know, there's a lot of rude questions in that survey, mm-hmm. which will go in my book. And then, my dad said to me, he was like, I've done one of them. And I was like, oh God. So I've read unwitting, because I don't know who's who. So I've read his one about all the stuff, which is a bit of a disgusting thought.
Well, one of the questions is, it's not only, about marital infidelity, but it's also, there's one about picking your nose. That's, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the nose picker, right.
The reason that's interesting to me is because while I've been researching, the essence of the secret, what secret keeping is, and it's secret keeping is something that can create more shame than we even realize. It can actually lead to both mental and physical illnesses if you keep too many secrets. So it's this really powerful thing. And there's loads of evolutionary, really interesting things about it. But there's also this thing of, where does a secret overlap with, for example, a lie? Is a lie a secret, right? Yes, or sometimes, maybe not. The other one is, when is it a secret and when is it privacy? What is privacy? What is a secret, right? The conclusion I've come to so far is that something that is done, something that is expected of you in the privacy of your own home, right? That is not a secret. So a couple that has sex regularly, that's not really a secret, is it? They wouldn't want anyone to know, but it's not a secret. It's assumed. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a couple who never has sex, maybe that is a secret, right? Mm-hmm. That's like, oh, have you heard about that? It becomes a secret. So it becomes about this active hiding of something. It's an active hiding. And nose picking was interesting, I thought, just because it's so common. I think so far something like 85% of people have said they do it regularly, like a lot. And we almost never see people doing it. It's seen as like the most disgusting, shameful thing. And it's right on the boundary of, like, some people were saying, but that's privacy, because you expect people to pick their nose at home. And I was like, well, I don't know if I did expect that, actually. I thought, maybe am I the only one, or is someone else the only one? Maybe that's a secret. And still 15% or 20% are saying they've never done it. They never put their noses.
Lies.
Yeah. Lies. I know.
Everyone's put their nose.
Exactly. And I don't know if my father was in the 80% who does or the 15 or 20% who don't, but I'm sure I've seen him do it. So.
Well, I hope it's only the picking his nose that he's been on there, because there were some pretty deep questions on there. But we ramble on. What will the book be called?
I don't know yet. It's so early. You'll have to get me back on when it comes out in about a year and a half if it even gets a publisher. So I don't even know. But I've written like 20,000 words. I've been going mad with it.
That's a lot of words. Well, yeah. I think it's fascinating, and to be able to, obviously you take the scientific side and you get the sociologists and whatever, but and the scientists and the psychologists, but then your side to these things and make it more digestible. Because that's
personal,
the idea, isn't it?
And accessible.
Well, thank you so much for this and for sharing and for the story, the bus story and Chinchina and Medellin and everything else. And the mention of the page 3 girls, it takes me back to the time past. And I wanted to say something quickly, because you mentioned one of your episodes, the female Mormon psychopath. It just made, in my head, that just sounds like a Russ Meyer movie, you know? the title.
Who's Russ Meyer?
He did things like movies that were always a bit bawdy. And it was like, I think one of his was Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. things like that. So female Mormon psychopath sounds, summary, in that paragraph. Anyway, listen. People can find your podcast everywhere. It's on every platform, and they can find you as well on Patreon. So they can throw a few dollars, pounds, euros your way if it's always needed.
Well, they won't want to until they've heard. I think you typically have to have heard 5 or 6 episodes before somebody starts going, you know what? It would be strange if they started giving me money before they even listened to the first.
But do so anyway. I mean, that's...
Yeah, please do.
Listen, Andrew, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and so on. It's been a real pleasure here on the Columbia Calling podcast. And when the book is out, and if you're not too famous, please come back on the Columbia Calling podcast and tell us all about it, and tell us about, I don't know, the demographic of people in Columbia picking their noses. Well, there you go. So listen, look it up. Listen to the podcast. Really interesting indeed. And so that's this week. We're going to sign off. I've been Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, talking to Andrew Gold of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. Check out the podcast. A big thank you again for being on this episode 371. And we'll be back next week with further interviews or further conversations with people with some sort of tenuous link to Colombia, of course. And thank you. It's been a lot of fun.